Escape Pod 176. September 19th, 2008. Today's story, How the World Became Quiet, A Post-Human Creation Myth, by Rachel Swirsky.
Hello and welcome to Escape Pod. I'm Steve Ely. I believe this week's story takes a little context. When I was a teenager, one of the SF novels that most blew my mind was a very old classic called Last and First Men. This was written by a British philosopher named Olaf Stapledon in 1930, and it's a future history of the rest of human civilization over the next few billion years. He starts off predicting the rest of the 20th century, and then accelerates, and has humans evolving at different times into bird creatures and giant brains and terraforming Venus and Neptune. 18 species of humanity, and it was totally amazing. I'd never come across anything like it. Since then, the only book I've read with a grander scope was Stapledon's other famous novel, Star Maker, which is a similar history of the entire universe. In that literary vein, but somewhat different in its vision, we have this week's story, How the World Became Quiet, A Post-Human Creation Myth, by Rachel Swirsky. Ms. Swirsky lives in Iowa, and she's had stories in Interzone, Subterranean, Fantasy Magazine, our horror podcast Pseudopod, and Cthulhu Sex Magazine. I've got to say that one again, Cthulhu Sex Magazine. She's best known to many of you, however, as the editor of the fantasy podcast Podcastle, which, in its first 6 months, is already becoming one of the largest venues for fantasy fiction. You can find it at podcastle.org. I'm a fan. The story is read for us by, well, I have to confess, when I bought this, I could only imagine it read by Frank Key. He's the writer and narrator of the most surreal prose radio show I've ever heard, Hooting Yard, which plays on the fabulous Resonance FM radio station in London. You can discover his writing at hootingyard.org, where you can also buy his two books, Befuddled by Cormorants and Unspeakable Desolation Pouring Down from the Stars. Fear not, till Birnam Wood do come to Dunsinane, it's story time.
How the World Became Quiet, A Post-Human Creation Myth, by Rachel Swirsky. Part 1. The Apocalypse of Trees. During the first million years of its existence, mankind survived 5 apocalypses without succumbing to extinction. It endured the apocalypse of steel, the apocalypse of hydrogen, the apocalypse of serotonin, and both apocalypses of water, the second of which occurred despite certain contracts to the contrary. Mankind also survived the apocalypse of Greece, which wasn't a true apocalypse, although it wiped out nearly half of humanity by clogging the gears that ran the densely packed underwater cities of Lore, but that's a tale for another time. Humans laid the foundation for the 6th apocalypse in much the same way they triggered the previous ones. Having recovered their ambition after the apocalypse of serotonin and rebuilt their populations after the apocalypse of Greece, they once again embarked on their species' long-term goal to wreak as much havoc as possible on the environment through carelessness and boredom. This time, the trees protested. They devoured buildings, whipped wind into hurricanes between their branches, tangled men into their roots, and devoured them as mulch. In retaliation, men chopped down trees, firebombed jungles, and released genetically engineered insects to devour tender shoots. The pitched battle decimated civilians on both sides, but eventually, though infested and rootless, the trees overwhelmed their opposition. Mankind was forced to send its battered representatives to a sacred grove in the middle of the world's oldest forest and beg for a treaty. Negotiations went slowly, since the trees insisted on communicating through the pitches of the wind in their leaves, which astute linguists played back at 1,000 times normal speed in order to render them comprehensible to human ears. It took a day for a sentence, a week for a paragraph, a month for an entire stipulation. After 10 years, a truce was completed. To demonstrate its significance, it was inked in blood drawn from human victims and printed on the pulped and flattened corpses of trees. The trees agreed to cease their increasing assaults and return forevermore to their previous quiescent vegetable state in exchange for a single concession. Mankind would henceforth sacrifice its genetic heritage and merge with animals to create a new, benevolent sentience with which to populate the globe. After the final signatures and root imprints were applied to the treaty, the last thing the trees were heard to say before their leaves returned to being mere producers of chlorophyll was this: "At least it should keep them busy for a millennium or two, fighting among themselves." Part 2. The Animals Who Lived as Men. Mankind, as history had known it, was no more. The new hybrids wore bodies constructed like those of mythological beasts, a blend of human and animal features. They scattered into the world's forests, deserts, jungles, and oceans, where they competed with unmixed animals for food and territory. If some ancient legends were to be believed, men were only returning to their ancient roots as dolphin and lizard, raven and grizzly bear. Other traditions would have been appalled that man had cast himself down from his place at the apex of the chain of being and been consigned to the lesser links below. Intellectuals became the whale men who kept their faces but lost their bodies for the streamlined shape of cetaceans. Their sentience blended with the intelligence already inhabiting those massive blubbery forms. They indulged in abstract philosophy as they swam through the ocean depths in a silence created by the first absence of shipping lines in 500,000 years. Pilots and acrobats became glider men, acquiring huge eyes, wing flaps, and nocturnal habits which served them well as they arrowed from tree to tree in forests that echoed with their eerie sonar calls. Eight-armed crab men spent their days skittering up and down beaches, dancing for the gulls. Spotted jaguar men skulked through forests. Cold-blooded turtle men inched through years. Flattened stingray men lurked on river bottoms, awaiting unwary travellers. For the first 20,000 years, mankind peacefully coexisted in all its forms. After that, the buried genetic contribution of the human mind bubbled to the surface. "The treaty is an outgrown shell to be discarded," young crab men gestured defiantly with their third and sixth arms. Crab matrons clapped their claws in outrage, but who could control the youth? The most extreme of the crab men formed a rebel sect called the Weeders. They wove strands of kelp around their eye stalks and ritually cut their seventh arms, searing the wounds with a mixture of brine and gull guano. At first, they expended their rage on symbolic targets, dumb, unblended seabirds or rocks shaped like dolphin men. And then a juvenile weeder called Longstalks found an injured seal man bleeding on the beach and dragged him home in time for the evening convocation. The weeders tore him to pieces, rubbing themselves with his blubber and parading in his fur, the meat they left to rot. When they discovered the decaying corpse, the crab matrons went to the seal men with offerings and apologies, but the seal men refused to hear diplomacy. They clipped off the delegation's claws and sent the mutilated ambassadors home with a terse condemnation. "You didn't even have the courtesy to eat him." Seal and crab men hunted each other to extinction in less than a decade. The last crab man sidled 400 miles inland to a camp of parrot men before expiring with a curse on his lips. Soon it was hyena man versus eagle man and frog man versus capybara man, then tiger and spider and cockatiel men against snake and giraffe and ostrich men. Amidst the hectic formation and betrayals of alliances that seethed on the battlefield, only one order created a stable federation. These were the insect men, greatest of all the species of men in their variety and achievements. Their infantry were the mosquito men, fearsome female warriors with the muscular bodies of Amazons topped by tiny blood-sucking heads. They marched wherever battle raged, drinking the blood of fallen soldiers. They were sliced and swatted, crushed and grasped in giant crocodilian jaws, but still the indomitable parasites survived to carry samples of their victims' blood back to their superiors, the butterfly men. Oh, the tragedy of the butterfly men, wisest of the insect men, whose useless jewel-coloured wings draped from their slender shoulders like robes. These were the descendants of the geneticists who engineered the destruction of mankind, innocent victims of their ancestors' self-flagellation. Forced to subsist on honey and chained to a lifespan of less than a week, these shrewd but ephemeral leaders did not even enjoy the consolation of flight. Instead, they lingered in forest glades looking pale and melancholy. Liable to terrible moods, they made love in the underbrush one moment and shredded each other's wings the next. Yet the geneticists' legacy was not entirely bad, for they had left their descendants the gift of instinct. Inscribed into the rapid pathways of their ephemeral brains lay an intricate understanding of DNA and genetic manipulation. Using this knowledge, the butterflies divined their enemies' secret anatomical weaknesses from the blood samples which the mosquito men brought to them. Generations of butterfly men scrutinized each vial in order to create fatal viruses which would massacre their enemies' ranks. Only when the last disease had been designed did the butterfly men let loose the fruits of their labor. Simultaneously, 100 deadly plagues seized their victims, sweeping across the earth in a single night. By morning, only the insect men remained. High on an isolated cliff in a desert that had once been the Amazon, a cluster of hardy Joshua trees broke their ancient silence to speak once more. Wind rushed through the prickly tufts of their leaves, rustling out a single sentence. That didn't take long, did it? Part 3. The Reign of Insects. Though the butterfly men's cunning won the war, their flighty emotions and brief lifespans made them unsuitable for leading a world, and so it was that the cockroach men became the rulers of the earth. Tough enough to survive dismemberment because their brain processes were spread throughout their bicarapaced bodies, and possessed of the keen and supernatural senses of scavengers who had once lived among creatures many hundreds of times their own size, the cockroaches had the desire and capacity to enact a reign of fascism on the other insect men, the like of which had never been seen before. Ant-men and bee-men filled the roles of farmers and drudges. Atlas and rhinoceros beetle-men provided brute force. Flea and mite-men accomplished those tasks requiring agility. Mosquito-men served as the secret police. The cockroach-men sent them to swarm on enemies of the state and drain them dry, and there was never a lack of traitors to keep them fed. Alas, the plight of the butterfly men was only to become worse, for the cockroach men were loath to risk the same end which had befallen their enemies. To ensure their safety from the butterflies' dangerous knowledge, they imprisoned the butterfly men in a dark chain of underground caves where they lived their brief miserable lives out of the sun's reach. Within a season and 12 generations, all conscious knowledge of how to create viruses from blood was gone, but the butterfly men's unhappy descendants remain incarcerated in their underground cells today. Above ground, bees and ants march to the cockroaches' well-timed rhythm, carrying crops from outlying farms into the hills of the city. Caravans of travelling gypsy moth men departed each hour, on the hour, and the cockroach men began great civil works projects to erect bridges and statues and roads and memorials and temples. Larvae were taken away from their hatches and forced to work at back-breaking labour past adulthood. Dragonfly men journalists reported only that on the prevailing winds of fascism. Hives were routinely broken up to redistribute the working population. While the other insect men lived poor and wintry lives, subsisting on meagre grain, the cockroach men gorged on honey, orange peels, and mouldy bread. Those who dissented disappeared, only to be found as blood-drained corpses swinging from sturdy branches. Yet all this might have endured were it not for the deadliest sin of the cockroach men. Ancestrally predisposed to look favourably upon debris, the cockroach men allowed their wastes to build up in giant landfills. Junkyards choked out the fields, garbage seeped into the groundwater, rotting trash provided breeding grounds for the nastiest, most virulent epidemics and hemorrhagic fevers. When the first wave of ant men died of a plague that turned their exoskeletons scarlet, at first the cockroach men suspected their old accomplices, the butterfly men, but when they went to interrogate them, no one could remember where that unhappy species had been stashed. The trees cried out against what was happening to them. New bacteria chewed through leaves and blocked out photosynthesis. Roots withered in poisoned soil. Things would only get worse, they knew. Oh, how they would suffer. Across the globe it would be the same for all things natural. Seas would rumble, ecosystems shatter. Even the iron-breathing Archaeans in the deepest volcanic vents would perish if the cockroach men were allowed to continue on their path. "This will hurt you too, Earth," the trees wailed, not in the language of wind in leaves, which they had used to communicate with the humans, but in the language of roots in ground and life in soil. And the Earth heard their plight. It shivered, cracking the supercontinent down the middle like a slice of lightning splitting the sky. "I have seen enough of mankind's ability to make trouble," it rumbled to itself in the language of magma under crust, and it initiated the seventh apocalypse, the apocalypse of darkness. The apocalypse of darkness was the most terrible yet suffered by mankind. Untold agony wiped out almost the entire population of the globe. Three cricket men survived. They woke quaking into the dawn, antennae shivering down their backs. They were two females and a male, and they might have carried their line into future generations, but the three of them regarded each other with dark compound eyes that reflected the same understanding. "We must never bear children," said the oldest and wisest. "Or someday we might tell them what we have experienced, and we must never damn another soul to see what we have seen, even by picturing it in their minds." The others agreed, and the three of them leapt off the tallest cliff they could find, dying in silence. Though the details of the apocalypse of darkness are known, it would be disrespectful to the cricket men's sacrifice to record them. Interlude, Whisperings from Branch to Branch. "So, little rootlings, little seedlings, little starting to grows, that is why the earth is quiet now. Feel the snails trail across your bark. Listen to the birds trilling in your branches and the insects nibbling your leaves. Hear the snap of monkeys brachiating from branch to branch. With mankind gone, we're free to enjoy these things. Are they not good?" "Ah, but by now you've guessed, the time of man is not yet entirely behind us. Why else would we whisper this tale on a fine spring morning, with winter's frosts sweetly melted? Before the apocalypse of darkness, we did not tell each other stories. Through necessity, we have learned the skill. Next year, you will help us tell the starting to grows about the great cathedral mother who stood in the centre of the world until her children sprouted up in a ring around her and sucked up all the sunlight. Her trunk remains where she once grew, swollen with dead leaves and congealing sap and blind grubs. Someday, lightning will strike all the way through the earth, piercing her in two, and each half will grow into a tall, straight pine with a tip like a spear. One going up, one going down. And when this happens, everything we think we know about the world will change." The year after that we will tell the great love story of the garlanded tree and the hive of bees who fertilized her. But this is our most important tale. Like winter, man will return in his season. By the time he does, little rootling, you may have a great solid trunk like your mother, or perhaps you will have grown and perished and it will be your children standing, or your children's children. Whoever grows when mankind returns must remember how to drop their leaves and huddle naked in the snow. And also, when man comes back, we wish to return to him his history so that he may hold and regard it like a spring bloom budding on a new leafed branch, new and yet also old, a gift not unlike the one given last spring. Who knows? Maybe this will be the time mankind can learn from stories. Part 4. Hands yearning upward through the surface of the earth. Stretch your roots into the ground, little seedlings. Listen, can you hear life rustling under the soil? Who else but the butterfly men? The apocalypse of darkness did not faze them. Having become accustomed to their miserable state, they could no longer be depressed by the black. They crept anxiously through their underground dwellings, their bright wings beautiful and unseen, and whispered to each other, "Do you feel that? What's happening?" When the apocalypse was over, without knowing the reason for it, the butterfly men wept together for 24 full hours in cosmic mourning for the human race, of which they were now the sole representatives. But since their quixotic moods were often given to fits of communal sorrow, they failed to understand the uniqueness of the occasion. After that, it was as though a pall had lifted from the butterfly men. They no longer had surface cousins to envy, so they went about making their lives in the dark. Their society flourished. Their stymied flight sense muddled their sense of direction, so they built joyously everywhere, not knowing up from down or left from right. They laughed and fought and made love in the mud and created an entire caste system based on the texture of the useless flight powder that dusted their wings. Sometimes an unusual prophet among them dreamed of the surface and spoke of things called light and sun, and usually she was buried alive. But occasionally she wasn't, and then a new religion started, and some of the butterflies marched off through the dark to pursue their cult in a different set of caves. In the past millennia, these cults have gained power. Everyone has lost a sister or a cousin or a parent to their undeniable allure. Whispers among the fine-powdered aristocracy indicate that the cults have even gained sympathy among the inbred monarchy in their velvet-draped cocoons. Soon, perhaps, every butterfly will believe. The cults employ a diverse array of dogmas, rituals, taboos, gods, and mythologies, but they all share two common traits. All tell of an eighth apocalypse, when the earth will open up into a chasm so terrifying that it will unlock a new sensation, a sixth sense to accompany hearing, smell, touch, taste, and desire. And all require their devotees to spend one day of their week-long lives meditating to discern which direction is up, and then to raise their arms toward it and start digging.
And that was our story. This was a very stylistic piece. I can imagine that this time we'll get the very legitimate question, with talking angry trees, is this really science fiction? I choose to say yes, under the Damon Knight rule. Science fiction is what we're pointing at when we say it. And I point to the far future in this piece, and the themes of forgetting and rediscovery, and I think that the feel, the cautionary wonder it evokes, feels more science fiction than fantasy to me. You may or may not agree, but that's my story. Or rather, it's Rachel Swirsky's story, but it's my podcast, and I'm sticking to it. Besides, back in my pagan days, I did my fair share of talking to trees. You can learn a lot from a tree, you really can, if you listen to what it has to say, and if you find an outgoing, social, talkative tree. Now here's a promo for a podcast that takes me back a bit.
I need to take a reaction. Hi, this is Dave Slusher. I've been doing the podcast The Evil Genius Chronicles for several years now, and I've got a new project. In the 90s, I did a syndicated science fiction talk show called Reality Break. I got to talk to some of the biggest names in science fiction, fantasy, and other genres of fiction. Now I'm bringing that series back to life as a podcast at realitybreakpodcast.com. The revival will feature a mixture of new interviews with the writers of today, as well as some episodes from the archives. It'll be a big hoedown of fantastical literature, and you can experience it for yourself at realitybreakpodcast.com. Let's face it, can't we all use a reality break now and then? Thanks for listening.
Let me catch my breath quick, bugging me to death. The check is in the mail, I'll find your holy grail. But first, let me take a reality break.
Dave Slusher's home station for the Reality Break radio show was WREK at my alma mater, Georgia Tech. So I listened to it there, and his interviews were stellar. The podcast isn't a rerun of the show so much as a revival, and he has a mix of old and new content. The first half dozen episodes include old interviews with Robert Jordan, Will Eisner, and more recent stars like Cory Doctorow and Merle Lafferty. I recommend it at realitybreakpodcast.com. And now, feedback on EscapePod 169. How I mounted Goldie, saved my partner Lori, and sniffed out the people's justice. He's a cyber-enhanced talking dog, she's a foul-mouthed cop, they fight crime, and reality television. Commentary on this one was overwhelming, and overwhelmingly good. Digging for criticism, George said in the comments, quote, "This was shaping up to be a great story, but it's implausible that the dog be asked to switch off similes, but not profanity. The unnecessary profanity just makes it unfunny." Many other commenters defended the use of profanity. Some of them did so cleanly. Slick felt that the dog's constant enthusiasm was wearing on his ears after about 15 minutes, and V felt that the plot was a bit unoriginal and the sound quality faltered by the end. Other than that, it was all really good. We had some very thought-provoking speculation about the People's Justice TV show and the implications of the future this story constructed, but I'm going to focus on the funny comments instead. Sayeth said, "Hilarious story! Thumbs up for Steve's voice, Jonathan's writing, and Dr. Bowie's ability not to laugh at Steve." Sayeth, "You have no idea." I Am a Fractal said, "That story smelled real good. I wanted to mount it." Ethan said, "Good doggy. Who's a good rule of law advocate? You are. Yes, you are." And Stuart said, "Steve, you are so convincing as a dog that I'm tempted to write to your wife and ask if she ever has to tell you to stop licking your own testicles." Yeah, go ahead, Stuart. She could give you the counter-evidence. I do leave the house occasionally. Thanks to all of you for the kind words. I'd like to give thanks to Sully for letting us run that piece, which, incredibly, he'd given up on trying to get published. And thanks to Professor Bowie for her sterling work as the voice of the interrogator. Ensemble pieces are a lot more fun to do than solo readings, and with the right stories, we might try more of them in the future. Escape Pod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is distributed on a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives Treaty. I mean, license. You can copy us all you like, but you can't sell us or convert us into insect form. All of the rights are reserved by our authors. If you like this week's story, please tell a friend or blog about us. And if you can, please consider donating via the PayPal link on our site, escapepod.org. Also check out our horror podcast, Pseudopod, at pseudopod.org, and our fantasy podcast, Podcastle, at podcastle.org. Our music is by permission of Daikaiju. You can hear more from them at daikaiju.org. That was our show for this week. Our closing quotation comes from Megan Marco, author of Field Guide to the Apocalypse. Among her other advice, she includes this comfort, quote, "Don't blame yourself. The apocalypse wasn't your fault. Actually, it was just as much your fault as anyone else's. Come to think of it, if you're an American, it was probably about 80 to 90% more your fault than the average human. But don't let that get you down. It wasn't exclusively your fault. Unless you're the president. Then it might be your fault. But you'll have plenty of interns to tell you it wasn't, so you'll be fine." Barring the apocalypse, we'll see you next week. Until then, have fun.